Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. The New York Yankees don't have rebuilding years or decades the way many other franchises do, but in recent years the club has undergone something of a transformation. Gone are the days of owner George Steinbrenner threatening jobs on the back pages. The core of the club is now homegrown. And instead of grinding down their Spanish-speaking prospects, the Yankees are teaching them language and life skills, as well as the wheel play. Veteran New York baseball writer Bob Klapisch covers that and much more as the co-author of the new book, Inside the Empire, The True Power Behind the New York Yankees, which focuses on the 2018 season. We began by talking about the role and evolution of longtime general manager Brian Cashman.
The first 10 years of Brian's tenure working under George, I think his prime motivation was to not get fired. And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean, really, every other manager or general manager before Brian or during Brian's tenure had been dismissed by George angrily, usually on the back pages of the New York Post. And each one of those men, very experienced and accomplished executives, would come into the job thinking, well, I'm going to teach George a lesson. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to make him see the error of his ways. I'm going to change George. And, of course, you know, that plan never works. You never win with George. Nobody ever won. And Cashman was the first one to realize that the only way to not get fired as a Yankee executive or as a Yankee general manager is to be the matador with the raging bull. Let the beast exhaust itself. Let George rant and rave. Let him think he's in charge. Give him the back page as often as he wants. Sidestep the storm as it comes charging at you. And stand up to him when necessary. And Brian picked his battles. I mean, he knew that you couldn't let George run all over you all the time. But in those rare instances where he felt strongly enough, he knew that he had to make his point. He stood up to George, and very often, as is the case with a bully, if you stand up to him, they will often back down. And ultimately, George did respect Brian to a great extent. He really did. He was the first one that he didn't fire, and it's a reason why Brian has never been dismissed in a town where everybody gets trashed, everybody gets canned, everybody has their legacy ruined one way or another. Doesn't matter how great you are, doesn't matter if you're in the Hall of Fame or not. I'm thinking of Joe Torre. Sooner or later, they're going to run you out of town. Cashman is the last one standing. Last January, I went to him and said, look, Brian, your story has never really been told. You've been overshadowed by George. You've been overshadowed by Joe Torre. You've been overshadowed by Alex Rodriguez, by Derek Jeter. And yet here you are starting your 21st year in New York with never having had a losing season, and nobody has figured out why. No one has explained why. And he bought into it. He was willing to share his secrets, willing to share his relationships with Torre and Steinbrenner, Jeter, A-Rod, some of which were very contentious. It's Brian Cashman pulling back the curtain to take us through those last 20 years. The first 10 under George and the 10 since then, as he has put his own imprint on the Yankees.
You know, in that time, GMs have gotten younger and they've focused a lot more on analytics. Brian Cashman's in his early 50s now. He's only ever worked for the Yankees because he came up as an intern. What keeps him motivated and what keeps him so determined to succeed in this position?
Well, I think, you know, that's a great question. You know, I think he really wants to keep this job until the day he keels over at his desk. I think he wants that to be his legacy, the general manager who outlived them all, the longest-running executive in Yankee history. He takes a great deal of pride in his record, his track record, especially under George, never having been fired by George, and the fact that the Yankees never have had to break it down, rebuild. Unlike the Red Sox, they've never had to finish last, or like the Cubs or the Astros. There's never been a bottom-to-top climb. The Yankees have always been at the top or near the top, and Brian takes a great deal of pride in that. And, you know, the other part about his personality that makes him so enduring and so long-lasting is that he doesn't really have an ego. He would rather work from the back of the press box than the front. He doesn't want to be on the back page of the New York Post. He doesn't want those 100-point headlines. And, you know, one of the premises of the book, one of the stipulations for him to grant us access, he said, you guys have to give credit to my assistants because I don't do this alone. I mean, there are many people around me who are smarter than me, and I trust them, and they do a great job because I don't micromanage them. And that's the real difference between him and George, who preceded him, is that Brian trusts his lieutenants, and he's never walking around the office looking to fire people. So I think that keeps him current. It makes for great chemistry in the Yankee front office, and he's open to new ideas always. And you have to be that way in baseball right now because it's evolving so quickly, and it really is a young man's sport. Brian still has that youthful vibe about him. He has a youthful mentality, and it's been a great asset.
Tell us about the new generation of Steinbrenners who have had more reluctance about running the baseball side of the family business. They're not spending way over the cap the way they used to. What's their approach to owning the team?
Well, we're really talking about Hal Steinbrenner because he's front and center now. He's the principal owner. I mean, his sister Jennifer is involved, but in the background, and Hank Steinbrenner was sort of like the black sheep of the family. He's still involved, but no longer gives interviews and is no longer in the public eye. Everyone has sort of rallied around Hal to let him be the face of the Steinbrenner legacy. And Hal and George just couldn't be more different, whereas George was boisterous and you know, he's sort of like a Donald Trump figure. I mean, you find Hal to be as reticent as you can imagine, you know, as a completely different person, probably because he grew up with such a domineering and dominating father. I said to Hal, you know, and he doesn't give interviews very often, unlike George, who just loved to just stand in the press box and let reporters interview him forever, knowing that it would all be on in the Daily News and the Post the next day.
You said your first job was waiting for him to call back.
Yes, I said to Hal, look, I started way back in the 80s when, back before there was cell phones or texting. I mean, to cover George, you had to call him and wait for that call back, and literally wait by the phone. And he wasn't even in New York. You had to call American Shipbuilding in Cleveland to get a hold of him. And if you were lucky, he called back. Some days he did, some days he didn't, depending on his mood or his schedule or whether or not he wanted to help the New York Post, which is where I started my career, or if he felt like helping the Daily News that day. And it was totally at random, and it was a very harrowing experience. And George would call. When he called, he didn't do it through a secretary. He would just call you and start talking. He didn't say, this is George. He wouldn't say, hi, Bob, how you doing? I'm returning your call. No, he would just start talking nonstop. And, you know, if you were lucky, you got a great story out of him. But if you were a 24-year-old reporter just starting out, it was very intimidating. And I said to Hal, you know, I did this job back in the 80s right out of college, and my first assignment was the Yankees and covering your father. And I have to be honest with you, he scared the hell out of me. And Hal just roared with laughter. He says, believe me, he scared the hell out of me too. And that really explains to a great deal why Hal is so reticent, you know, and why he's such a shy person. You know, he told an interesting anecdote. He said he was walking in New York City, you know, before his father had passed, and before Hal himself had assumed power in the organization. He saw Billy Crystal walking on Park Avenue with a hood pulled down low over his head, wearing a baseball cap, sunglasses, looking down, making sure not to make eye contact with anyone, clearly did not want to be recognized. And Hal thought to himself, what a terrible life that must be, to be constantly in fear of the paparazzi, autograph seekers, you know, fans, whatever. You just don't want to be noticed. He goes, I don't ever want to be famous. I don't want to be that person who has to hide from the public, which is completely different than his father. And I don't think that that's a coincidence.
Let's go into the clubhouse now and talk about some of the big names around the club. I want to start with Joe Girardi, because he had spent a decade as manager, won a World Series, and then things ended in a hurry for him after the team went out of the playoffs in 2017. So why did things sour in the end between Girardi and the Yanks?
Well, it was not a process. You know, it was a process which Joe started to lose the clubhouse. You know, I mean, after a number of years, every manager eventually cycles out. Their message is just no longer heard for whatever reason. I mean, just sometimes just because of the number of years they're in the room and the methods just lose their effectiveness. I mean, Joe Girardi was the right manager after Joe Torre because he was so hardworking and he was so efficient and he was so organized. And Joe Torre's reign had clearly come to an end. I think he had lost energy and had lost interest in the team by 2007. So the pendulum swung completely the other direction for Girardi, and it worked right away. The Yankees got themselves a world championship in 2009. But, you know, if you know Girardi and you spend even 5 seconds with him, you get the sense right away that this guy is, it's the equivalent of having a high school football coach in your clubhouse or a state trooper in your clubhouse. I mean, he's a 47-year-old man with a crew cut. That pretty much sums him up. And as the years went on and the age gap grew wider between Girardi and the players, they started to just suffer from an inability to communicate with each other. I mean, younger players started to complain to the front office that Girardi just didn't talk to them, didn't understand them, didn't seem to have any interest in them. And, you know, I should note that the role of the manager in the modern game has changed so much. It really isn't about strategy anymore or knowing when to bring in the right relief pitcher or when to call for the hit and run, because advanced analytics has handled all of that. There isn't a situation in the game that hasn't already been analyzed and spit out on some software program which will predict the likelihood of success in any situation, at any point in the game. So the era of a manager playing a hunch or going by his gut, I mean, that's completely obsolete now. A manager's job is to get the most out of his players, to get that extra gear, especially in the postseason or in the pennant race. Girardi had lost that because he didn't have the clubhouse anymore. So even though the Yankees got to within a game of the World Series, I mean, they had that fantastic run, as you mentioned, in 2017, almost upset the Astros. Girardi thought he had won and he'd earned himself another contract because of it. But over time, over the last year or two, the Yankees and Brian Cashman in particular realized that Girardi's methods were no longer working. It was just a stale chemistry between him and his players. Time for the pendulum to swing the other way, which is how Aaron Boone got his job.
Yes.
A different person altogether.
He came out of left field to a certain degree because he'd never been a manager or a coach before, but people who were around him in his job as a broadcaster noticed just how interested he was in, you know, the minutia of the game. So how is he working out so far here in the beginning part of year two?
Well, I think that if you spend 5 seconds with Aaron Boone, you'll realize why people love him. I mean, he's a great guy. He has this warm personality. He has the personality traits that Girardi lacked. And players like him. They play hard for him. You know, the Yankees went out and won 100 games for him in his first year, so you would have to say last year was a success, even though the Yankees didn't get to the World Series. I would say that Aaron Boone is the perfect manager for the Yankees between April and September, over the long haul, a day in and day out, in which you have to have good chemistry in that clubhouse, and the Yankees do. What remains to be seen, and we'll find out as Season 2 goes on, as to whether or not Boone can get the most out of his players, that extra gear I was talking about, in October. Now, Alex Cora was able to do it last year with the Red Sox. Everything he did worked, in part because the players loved him. They bought in on his style, his personality, his demeanor. They loved the guy, and every crazy move he made in the postseason, they trusted, and everything clicked. We'll see if the Red Sox can repeat that. I don't think they can, but it's really it's on Aaron Boone now to emulate that and duplicate that to see if he can get that gear out of the Yankees the way that Cora did out of the Red Sox in 2018.
One observation you make in the book, it comes down to Aaron Judge, who's emerged as the face of this Yankee era. How important is Aaron Judge to the way the team operates on a day-to-day basis, if he's playing well, if he's in the lineup versus if he isn't?
Well, I think all you have to do is look at the way the Yankees played for 7 weeks while he was on the injured list last year with that broken wrist. They just tread water. I mean, they were not the same without him. I've been covering baseball long enough to know and to remember how Keith Hernandez impacted the Mets in the late 80s. He was a leader on and off the field. He had that sort of that man's man personality that just inspired his teammates to play better just because he was on the field with them. I mean, Keith had that thing. And it's hard to quantify, but there's something about Keith that just made the Mets an ability to elevate their game when he was in the lineup. Same thing with Judge. And Judge is, you know, he's never won a championship. He's, you know, only 26 years old. He doesn't have the track record that Hernandez did by the time he got to the Mets. But he has that ability to make the players around him better. And just to show you the respect that the Yankees have for Judge and Cashman in particular, when they were about to acquired Giancarlo Stanton last January. Just before the deal was consummated with the Marlins, Cashman called Aaron Judge and said, look, I have a chance to pick up Stanton, knowing, of course, the two players, they play the same position. Somebody was going to have to move, or there was going to have to be some accommodation. And Cashman's thinking was, if Judge has a problem, any problem at all with Stanton, I need to know about it now, and instead of reading about it in the New York Post 3 days from now. But true to his nature, true to his, you know, all-in, you know, team-first nature, Judge says, you got to get this guy, no matter what it takes. I'll play any position you want me to, but if we have a chance to get Stanton, remember, he was just coming off winning the National League's MVP award. if we have a chance to get Stanton, please do it. Don't even hesitate. That's the kind of player that Judge is, the kind of person that he is, and the kind of respect that the Yankees have for him overall.
Last thing, Bob, you know, you've been involved in some very high profile tabloid baseball moments in recent New York history, dating back to like David Cohn's ghostwritten column and Bobby Bonilla and so on. And is it more boring covering baseball in New York when the Yankees are as professional and as sort of dialed down as they are nowadays?
Another excellent question. I would say it's a different industry altogether. You know, I mean, the players are different. Sports writing is different. I mean, there's so much more information. First of all, I will say that the analytics part of it, just being able to evaluate players as a writer, there are so many more tools available to me now than back in the 80s and 90s. Just because technology has improved. Now, instead of saying such and such player can help the Yankees, now I can pinpoint and say how much a player can help. But in terms of the clubhouse and, you know, the really interesting parts of the job that I used to love so much in the 80s and 90s, that's gone. I mean, the players themselves have been coached in terms of what to say and not to say. The interviews have become so homogenized. And the one-on-one access in that room has virtually been eliminated. Everything now is in a press conference-type setting. Just the overall relationships between the press and players has changed, and it's much more formal and distant. I would say the really interesting players in the game are gone, just as the really bad guys, the real jerks, are gone. I mean, that's all been distilled out to everybody sort of in the middle. And you just won't have incidents like that anymore, like the one I had with Bobby Bonilla. It just doesn't happen because the clubhouse is so carefully monitored now by PR staff, and players have been so carefully coached and schooled in what to say and how to stay out of trouble. And, you know, part of that is also because of social media. I mean, players are just afraid of Twitter. They're afraid of Snapchat and Instagram. I mean, everything you say now is recorded one way or another, and everybody's watching what they say, exactly knowing that any wrong step, any wrong move will end up on social media in 30 seconds. So players are a little less forthcoming. I should say they're a lot less forthcoming, which in turn makes the job of the sports writer a lot less colorful. Although, like I said, in terms of consuming the sport, information, player evaluation, and analytics, there's a lot more there now. But I prefer the old-fashioned way, I guess just because I'm old.
Bob Klapisch is the co-author of Inside the Empire, The True Power Behind the New York Yankees, and his tour of New York outlets continues. You can follow his baseball coverage this season in the New York Times. Bob, thank you so much for taking this time for us, and enjoy the rest of the season.
Well, thank you for having me on. It was really a pleasure.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.